And good morning and welcome to this August 9th, 2017 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. Today we are diving into fiction again. This is the most delicious novel I have read all summer. It's a fantastic novel. I am excited this morning to be with Jonathan D. The book is The Locals, and in the second half I will be chatting with Sherry LaPenna about her new novel, A Stranger in the House. Jonathan D. is the author of seven novels, including A Thousand Pardons and The Privileges, which was a finalist for the 2011 Pulitzer Prize. He is a recipient of the fellowships of the National Endowment of the Arts and the Guggenheim Foundation. He teaches in the graduate writing program at Syracuse University, which makes me suspect he's over there with George Saunders. His latest is The Locals. It's published by Random House. It is wonderful and is the subject of our chat this morning. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks so much for coming on. I feel like, you know, sitting here 200 plus days into the Trump presidency and all that is going on, that, you know, we're kind of looking to the seers who feel now to us like they saw some of this coming. And having read this novel, it feels to me like you're one of those seers, because I assume this book was finished far before the election ever happened. So I want to kind of unpack all of that and what you saw and how you saw it.
It was finished, I guess, last summer, just a little bit more than a year ago. And I wish I had seen it coming. If I had seen it coming, I would have done something. But I feel like the book's more about, I mean, it's accidentally become even, you know, more timely than it might have been, of course, because of the Trump election. But it's really more about the currents in American political and cultural life that maybe he was able to tap into. And the book itself spans the years from 2001 to 2010. So before Trump was anything more than just an annoying reality TV host.
Right. Yeah, so take us a little bit more into it. And when did you start writing it?
2013.
Okay.
And I feel like, you know, the one of the things that animated it was the sense, which had been, again, you know, kicking around American political life for a couple of decades at least, the sense that you know, rich people may be suspect, but really, really rich people achieve a strange sort of moral purity because somehow they can't be bought. I lived in New York City for many years, and so was there for the Bloomberg mayoralty, which the character in The local Philip Haiti, I think, you know, bears more of a resemblance, probably not that he's you know, based upon Bloomberg, but he's more of a Bloomberg figure than a Trump figure.
Yeah.
And in the wake of 9/11, he moves from the city to what was once his summer or weekend home in the Berkshires, and moves up there full time.
Yeah, it's you know, I love this setting because it feels both very specific and very universal. You know, we all know towns like this, even though you have spent kind of relatively little time in the Northeast. I felt immediately connected to this place, immediately connected to these people. And maybe you can talk a little bit about Howell and kind of how that town emerged from your psyche and achieving both that specificity and that universality.
Well, you're right. There are towns like Howland all over the country, just resort towns, summer towns that are usually picturesque, bucolic, and near to some kind of urban center where people have money to spend. So that the communities themselves are both dependent on that kind of outsider summer or tourist money, and also resentful of it. And I hit upon the Berkshires for a few reasons. One is that I think, you know, I didn't really want to set the novel in an explicitly red state kind of you know, location, because then it becomes a different sort of book, and it seems like it's talking about something maybe other than what it's talking about. Because in Massachusetts, certainly you get that great, you know, New England early American residence, and also maybe primarily because it's not far from where I grew up and I lived for many years, not in Massachusetts, but just over the border, and I know that area pretty well. Howland, I should say, for those of your listeners who have never been there, is an imaginary place that I've set down amidst the real small towns up there.
So great. So talk about the point of entry. Did this start with the characters? Did it start with kind of our political situation? Was there one character in mind that, you know, that allowed this to take off? Or sort of talk about the original kernel of the idea.
You know, it's harder than you'd think to go back and remember that sometimes, but I think that the original seed of it was not a particular character or setting. But I wanted to try to find some way to write about a particular idea, which is what seems to me to be a really extraordinary reaction in American public life that began in retrospect around 9/11 and what seemed like a great moment of patriotism and solidarity, etc. There, and gave way in a very short time to the mainstreaming of the idea that the state itself or that collective action itself was suspect and should be dismantled, and that, you know, your problems are your problems, but they're not my problems. I felt like there's a kind of institutionalization of savagery that had become normalized very quickly. I thought often of the famous Grover Norquist line. He's the guy, the anti-tax lobbyist who says that he doesn't want to kill the government. He just wants to make it small enough so he can drown it in the bathtub. And that idea seemed to fascinate me, so I wanted to try to find some way to animate it or to dramatize it.
Yeah. It's I think it's so tricky to talk about class in this country. It's almost up there with talking about race. You know, it just is. It's confusing. It's uncomfortable, and I think it's interesting that there's kind of this ugly myth, or maybe this lie about the American dream that we can slide from class to class. That it's possible to,
yes,
you know, find your way from the lower class to either the middle or upper class. And the reality is that economic mobility in the U.S. I think is even far less likely here than in a lot of other nations of the world. I think I just read a statistic that's like 19 or 20 out of developed nations of how easy it is to switch between classes. And
that's it exactly. The fairy tale of class mobility and the idea that it's what you're supposed to want, and that other people will welcome that movement, especially people in the class above you. Yeah, that's you know, a foundational American idea, and it seems almost unshakable, even as, you know, as you say, the evidence and all the data points really in the other direction. But, the idea, it goes along, the idea of class mobility goes along with the slightly more abstract and maybe, you know, in some cases more appealing foundational American idea that you can escape your past. I mean, that you aren't a function of the world or the family that you were born into.
Right. Yeah, and so many of these characters bear that out. Where you say that it's difficult for the class above you to accept you, it's also difficult for the classes below you, I think, or the class that you were in to allow you to move. And
absolutely.
Family dynamics in here, so great. And the other, I guess, big interesting theme that runs through the novel is security and what we're willing to give up in order to feel we are safe, what liberties we're willing to give up in order to feel we're safe. And I think that, too, today, particularly today, is so much more relevant. The book is so prescient.
I agree. And the idea that in the end, you really don't have to take people's rights away from them. They'll hand them over in certain you know, political contexts like the one that we've been in really for the last 15 plus years. One way that the novel, at least the way I thought of making that a little bit more concrete, was that if there's a kind of keyword in the novel, it might be house or home, and the idea of what that means to various people. You know, houses as a birthright or as an asset or as an element of security or as something that rich people can still control after they die, et cetera. So there's a lot of talk in the book about houses and their various incarnations.
Right, right. So great. My guest this morning is Jonathan Dee. The book is The Locals, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. And, of course, through the course of this novel, the Internet is also coming alive. Blogging is a new phenomenon. I mean, I can't exactly now remember where we were with blogging and Internet connectivity in 2001 when the novel starts, but it's really sort of enjoying its infancy and teenagehood, I think, throughout the novel.
That was fun to write about. Although, yeah, also a challenge, as you say, because we forget so quickly. I had to go back and do as much research as I could do about what the technology was like, what the form itself was like back in the early years of this century. And you know, and I don't know. I mean, I always feel a little guilty writing about the Internet. I don't know why, but I feel like it's a kind of capitulation or collaboration to write prose about people writing blogs. But in the end, I had a lot of fun with it. I had a lot of fun imagining Jerry and his feverish method of composition and his teaching himself to hit post or send immediately, which is so unlike the way that I write everything.
Well, and I think it's something that we can't ignore, and especially, you know, with feeling like our elections have been hacked and the amount of bots out there and fake news out there. And, you know, you can't ignore it. I mean, I just think it's so woven into the fabric of now how we communicate with each other that, you know, it's the elephant in the room if you don't talk about it.
Yeah, that is true. That's true. It's only going to become more true.
Yeah. Right, right. So I want to get into kind of the structural things of the novel because a lot of our listeners are writers themselves, and there are so many wonderful writerly lessons, I think, in this novel. One of the more interesting, unique things about this book, I think, was the point of view. There's a large cast of characters. Almost the town itself is the cast of characters in the book, and there's almost this baton passing sort of nature of the point of view, which switches between characters, that gives them this feeling of both connectivity and they also really felt very isolated to me, but and lonely to me. But talk a little bit about that, about point of view, dealing with the challenges of that, dealing with the fun maybe of that, and kind of how you settled on that as a structure.
Well, once you get past that opening chapter, which we can talk about separately, then it does become there's a very large, almost in, you know, at times in the writing, an unwieldy cast of characters. And one of the inspirations that I had in mind while I was writing it was Middlemarch, unlikely as that might seem, because one of the many thrills of Middlemarch to me is when you reach certain points deep into the book and you've been living with these characters for hundreds of pages who live in the same small town, and yet you realize they don't even really know each other, or they barely know each other, because even in that tight geographical space, the social realms that they occupy are so different. So I wanted to find ways, the trick there, I guess, or the challenge there, is to find ways to do justice to a wide, you know, swath of characters while still moving the novel forward. And to me, I don't know how apparent this is to readers, but to me, each of the chapters has its own little formal quality that distinguishes it from the others. And I think the one that was maybe both the hardest and the most fun was the one it's the third chapter of the novel. It's labeled Chapter 2. And the dictum I gave myself there was no space breaks. And it's really harder than you might think to write 90 or 100 pages with a shifting point of view without just hitting that return key twice. You have to think of other more inventive mid-scene ways to, as you say, pass that baton. And the thing, I mean, you know, little formal games like that are fun. I like writing them and I like reading them, but really they are only worth it in the end if they convey something about the dramatic material itself, if they enhance or reflect something in the story. And so what I thought of, especially in that chapter, was the idea that in a small town, you or your intimately connected with each other, but and dependent on each other. But there's a sort of flip side to that, which is that you wish people were a little bit more distant from you. Sometimes your friends, or your family, or your neighbors, or maybe just a little bit more up in your business than you wish they were. So that's that chapter. I didn't do the whole book that way because I just thought it would. I mean, it would have exhausted me, and I think it would have exhausted the reader a lot sooner. But but for that one stretch there, it's just I'm just trying to find ways to switch the point of view in a way that's you know, coherent and trackable, but doesn't stop the action or stop the text.
Right, right. Yeah, you never got lost. I mean, it was definitely easy to follow in that way. But it did. I mean, I'm really curious about this notion of, as you say, people being kind of up in your business, and juxtapose that with the really pervading feeling of loneliness that I got from these characters, that they all felt so isolated from each other, and yet they were kind of on top of each other too much.
I think that's it. You know, you've hit on it exactly, because to me, that's the feeling of living in a place like that, as I did for a long time. People maybe do know more about you than you wish they did, but the day-to-day or the night-to-night quality of that existence is very lonely, even as opposed to, let's say, urban or apartment living, right? The sense of being on your own with, I think it's Candace who draws the shades at night, because at night you can see yourself in your own windows, and that sense of being isolated and in a tiny cramped space as well.
Yeah, right. Now, the one point of view character we don't get into his head is Haiti, who is our hedge fund billionaire, kind of the patriarch of the town, who's swooped in with his money to both dictate and save the town. And talk about that decision, not getting inside his head.
Yeah, I mean, I thought about getting into his point of view briefly, but I didn't think about it for too long. And I think that so much of the suspense of the book has to do with trying to figure out whether this guy really means what he says.
Yeah.
And so it's good for the reader to be in the position of the townspeople and to have the same evidence to evaluate that they do, and to see the different conclusions that they draw, and all the many wildly disparate things that they are able to project on him. One problem with inhabiting Haiti's perspective would be that from the moment you do that, then the other characters get divided up into camps, which is to say, some of them are right and some of them are wrong, and then and then the reader's relationship to them is altered. So I just thought it was best to put the reader more in the position of Howland resident, trying to figure out whether or not this guy can be trusted, and if not, why not?
Yes, absolutely. And it's really interesting. I would not compare Haiti to Trump whatsoever. I think Haiti probably would have hated Trump, but but when I think about how much time we all spend, and commentators all spend, and psychologists all spend, trying to get into Trump's head and figure out what he's going to do next, or what he's thinking, or where he's going, it's so unsettling to try and psychoanalyze somebody else. And what that does to the townspeople in this book, and kind of how it puts people on edge. It's just wonderful. I thought that was good.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
It's unsettling. I mean, I feel unsettled myself just day to day.
It's exhausting. It's just exhausting. But yeah. So let's go back and talk about chapter one, which is really kind of chapter zero. Kind of a prologue, and it's such a different texture than the rest of the novel, and yet it's so wonderful. And I feel like, having read the whole book and then looking back on chapter zero, I loved it even more. But I wanted you to kind of talk about that.
Good. Well, I'm glad that was your reaction. Yeah, especially in retrospect. Well, it's there were a few ideas that went into it. Sometimes, at the beginning of any novel, I get myself started just through some little formal perversion, you know, with the privileges. I thought, well, you know, a lot of books end with weddings. What if, you know, what would you do with a book that started with one? And here, I thought, I guess if I had a model for it, strange to say, it would be for, you know, the first 10 or so minutes of the Stanley Kubrick film 2001. I don't know if you've seen that recently, but it's a, you know, it's obviously it's a movie, it's a futuristic movie about space travel, and yet it begins with what amounts to a prologue set, you know, many thousands of years earlier, involving you know, cavemen or you know, proto typical men discovering tools. There's a famous 10,000 year smash cut from a bone flying in the air to a spaceship, and so the relationship between, you know, the so-called prologue, the relationship between that and the actual story is really purely thematic. So I wanted to do something like that. I wanted to do something that began the story, but really then kind of fell away, like the first stage of a rocket or something. So we do meet Mark Firth, who, if the novel has one central character, I mean, I don't think he is really central, but he's maybe the best candidate for that title. We do meet him in that prologue, but we meet him in an, you know, oblique, not immediately apparent way, and we see him through the eyes of someone who doesn't know him very well at all, and gets some things wrong about him, but also some things correct. So there was that, and there was also the fact that, as I said earlier, I mean, I think the whole story begins really on or around 9/11, even though that wasn't apparent at the time. And so I needed to find some way to get it onto the page, which is not easy to do for a number of reasons. But I liked the idea of this sort of nameless underground man who, you know, I mean, I lived in New York for a long time. I know that these guys are everywhere, but they don't necessarily get to narrate novels all that much, and to see events through a particularly weird and jaded and borderline offensive perspective that also, in retrospect, turns out not to be that wrong.
He was wonderful. Your nameless underground man. I mean, I don't know if he could have sustained a whole novel. When I started the novel, I was like, man, I'm going to live with this guy for 400 pages. But
yeah, actually, I have to say that was... At my publisher, that was the reaction among some people too, and they were a little worried that we needed to put up some kind of a flag for the reader to let him or her know that that, you know, don't worry, you're not going to be in this guy's head for 400 pages. But I
but being in his head for as long as we were was really great, because I thought it was really fun. It was unlike people I hang out with, so I enjoyed him.
Good.
Yeah. So a novel of this scope, I don't know if you're an outliner. Most people are not an outliner, but a lot of writers that I talk to kind of write it through and then in hindsight kind of go back and outline it. But I just kind of wanted to know your process of keeping this all in your head, especially this giant cast of characters, keeping them all in your head, keeping their storylines going, kind of what your office looks like and how you do that.
Well, it's interesting. I used to be, when I started writing, I was really a compulsive outliner, and that was partly just because I was young and didn't know what I was doing, and partly because I was, you know, anxious about not knowing what I was doing, and also partly because, you know, I had a job then, and the idea of wasted time was sort of terrifying to me. So the first couple of books that I wrote were outlined really almost scene by scene, and ever since then, I've been very conscious of trying to get away from that. I've been very conscious of now I'm very conscious of trying to make myself sit down and go really before I think I'm ready, because I wind up generating a lot of bad pages that way, but I also, you know, wind up, I've learned to put my trust in the idea that I can surprise myself in a good way. So I had the idea for that first chapter, and I wrote that through and then revised it over and over until I felt like it was where I wanted it. And then from there, I went, I'm not really straight through to the end, but each of the, you know, each of the chapters that follow that one, with the exception of the last, is, you know, somewhere around 100 pages long. So it's a good chunk of story. And I would write each of those straight through and then revise it. Okay. But not really, you know, not really outlining. And the only, you know, the closest I came to an outline would be maybe a one sentence description of each scene within those chapters. And like I say, I would just make myself go. And I wound up throwing out a lot, but now I've just learned to think of that as part of the cost of doing business.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have like a family tree or something in of these characters, little bio sketches?
Oh, I actually, no, but something I did at one point, I can't remember, you know, early on, but not that early on, I did sit down and write a little, maybe page and a half bio of each of the, you know, important or the point of view characters, certainly, plus Haiti in the novel. And so that was good because that gave me something I could go back to. And I did go back to them several times just to kind of give myself a refresher and make sure that I was, you know, going in the direction that I intended to be going in. Although there's also, you know, a ton of material, even as short as those biographies were, there's a lot that didn't get into the novel. But I think that's a good thing. I think, you know, there's such a thing as too much information in a novel, especially one with this many characters, and you have to find some way to keep its, you know, momentum going forward.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I feel like a lot of writers write to understand the world or write to make sense of what's going on, and I'm wondering how this novel maybe changed your perspective on the world, or maybe changed you as a person, or kind of what came out of this for you.
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's so good. I'm going to have to think of a way to give a short answer. But I do, you know, I'm more aware of that now as I, you know, get older, and as I've written more, especially when you're writing about political subjects. Honestly, like when I was young, I thought, you know, sort of wisdom would come with age, and I'd become much more tolerant and less fiery political than I was, you know, in my 20s. But if anything, the opposite has happened. I feel like I've just become, you know, when you read think pieces today about the terrible degradation of political discourse in this country, honestly, I'm part of that. I'm very impatient with, well, let's call them Republicans. You know, I'm very impatient with certain arguments, with certain, you know, trains of thought. And I wish I weren't, but I feel like my opinions actually get harder rather than more pliant. But the one place where that's not true, I've realized, is writing fiction. I mean, I don't think I would. It would be very hard for me to sit down and have a whole beer with, you know, Jerry Firth, for instance. I don't think I could stand it. But the experience of writing him, because of the imperative to make him interesting, to make him not a cartoon, to make him somebody in whom the reader can see him or herself, which means somebody in whom I can see myself. That's actually, you know, that's a good thing for me. That's a tonic for me, because the empathy that's required just to keep a story suspenseful is itself a habit of thought that I think maybe helps me, you know, move through the real world a little better.
I've had that conversation with a lot of writers lately, actually George Saunders as well, kind of what the role of the artist is in today's political turmoil. And that act of empathy, I think, for both the reader and the writer is really critical for all of us right now to become a little bit more sensitive to other people's point of view. And fiction's the best way to do that, I think. I mean, I think standing in somebody else's fictional but very truthful shoes is kind of one of the greatest things we can do at a point like this. So I think that's...
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And in order to, you know, to make that possible for the reader, and I have to begin with you making that leap yourself. And I'm very glad to hear that George thinks that too, because, you know, George is the kindest man in the world. So I'm glad that that even he, you know, finds a furtherance of that impulse in writing fiction.
Yeah, yeah. I never ask people what they're working on, because I think it's not all that appropriate to talk about what's coming. But if you have more of that seer stuff for the future that you'd like to share with us, that'd be great.
I've lost my ability, if I ever had it, to see what's coming, even tomorrow at this point. I mean, every day seems to bring some kind of fresh horror. So I'm not working on anything at the moment. But if I have some kind of a brainstorm, I'll try to capture it.
Yeah, call call me, because I was really hoping for that. You know, what's coming down the pike? Because I really want to try to be prepared.
I wish I could take more pleasure in the idea that I was prescient this time, but I'd give anything for it not to be true. So
yeah. Any last minute words of writing advice for writers out there? Anything that sustains you through these novels?
Patience. I think, you know, as you mentioned, since I teach here at Syracuse, I teach with George and Mary Carr and Dan Spiota and many other wonderful writers. And so I find that the thing that I wind up coming back to the most when talking to young writers is just the idea of making sure, balancing the idea that you have to make yourself work because no one else will make you do it, with being as patient as possible and making sure that everything that you send into the world is as good as it can possibly be, because, you know, when you write a good book, no one will ever say, well, it's good, but how long did it take you? You know, no one will ever say that. So just keep at it, you know, make yourself work hard, but as far as its relationship to the world outside of your office, just make yourself be as patient as you can.
Really, really good advice. Jonathan D., thank you so much. I've been singing this book's praises since I picked it up about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Everybody that its pub date was yesterday, so happy birthday. And that I encounter, I'm like, you got to read this book. It's just wonderful. So thank you so much for taking
the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was Jonathan D. We're going to take a very short break. Coming up next is Sherry LaPenna. Stay tuned. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads. There are upcoming shows listed up there, so you can see who's coming up on the program. There are speaker series events up there. There's another speaker series event coming up in September. You can check that out. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Sherry LaPenna is the internationally best-selling author of The Couple Next Door. Her latest novel is A Stranger in the House. It is published by Pamela Doran Books, a division of Viking. She was a lawyer and an English teacher before turning her hand to fiction. She lives in Toronto, and it is my huge pleasure to welcome her on. Sherry, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I love having thrillers on. This was a great summer read. So nobody introduces a book better than the writer themselves. And it's so funny because as I was reading this, I was like, this is going to be really hard to talk about because it's not even out yet. It comes out next week if people are listening live. The podcast of this show will come out commensurate with the release of the book. But it's safe to assume that most of our listeners have not read it. So I don't want to give anything away about it. But we're going to talk very... sidewinderly.
That's the problem with thrillers. When you want to talk about them, you can't too much into it without giving too much away.
Exactly right. So I'm going to let you do it. I'm going to let you talk about the introduction to the book and kind of take us into the world as much as you can, and then we'll kind of jump off from there.
Okay. So A Stranger in the House is another domestic noir about a married couple, Karen and Tom. And they live in the suburbs, and what I can tell you is that one night Tom comes home from work, and he finds that obviously his wife has fled the house in a hurry. She's left in the middle of making dinner, and he can't find her, and he starts calling all her friends and getting more and more worried, and he doesn't know where she is, and then the police arrive at his door with news that she's been in a terrible car accident. And then from there, we find out that the car accident occurred in a very awful part of town that she had no business being in. And I can also tell you that very soon after that, a murder is discovered and the police arrive at their door. And it starts to become a very tangled story about what the heck was the wife up to that night and how well does Tom really know his wife. And it goes from there.
Madness ensues.
Yes, madness ensues. And lots of tension, lots of, there's someone coming into the house, a stranger in the house, the title refers to the book in two ways. One, the stranger in the house is Tom's wife, because he doesn't really know much about his wife, he comes to discover. So she's a bit of a stranger to him. And also someone, it appears, is creeping into the house for some reason we don't know, and that is also a stranger in the house. So, yeah, lots going on, lots of secrets. Tom desperately wants to believe his wife and in the beginning completely believes his wife. But the police aren't so sure, and the neighbor has a suspicion as well. So, yeah, we start to find out what exactly is going on with Karen.
It's interesting to kind of the subtext of below the plot of the thriller is what makes a marriage and what couples owe each other about their past lives. And I thought all of those questions were very interesting. What love is, how love can change, what trust is, how trust can change, even if you have good reason for...
Yeah, and the question, this came up in an earlier interview somewhere I did where, you know, as you say, what do you owe your partner? And, you know, I was thinking that in the course of one lifetime, a person can live many different kinds of lives, you know, especially if you look at over the course of a long life, you know, someone who might have been a farm wife in the 30s in Saskatchewan, you know, by the 80s might be living a completely different life in a city somewhere with a completely different worldview. So it's possible for someone to live different lives and you know, how much, you know, if someone wants a new beginning, you want them to be able to have that new beginning. But on the other hand, you have a duty, I suppose, to truthfulness to your partner.
Right, right.
But then if you're trying to protect your partner, you know, how far does that duty go?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I always think that's interesting with children, too, what you owe your children about your past, and which is sort of some of their legacy and, you know, and your privacy. So I think all those issues are very interesting and complicate the thriller. You know, it's not just a whodunit or why done it. It's these more intimate questions.
The broader questions do arise, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So talk about the point of entry for this, kind of where the novel began. Was it with the situation? Was it kind of ripped from the headlines? Talk a little bit about the kernel of the idea for you and if that kernel of the original idea changed much over the course of writing the book.
What I generally do is I'm not someone who plans the whole thing out in the beginning. I usually start with an idea or a premise, and it usually involved an interesting situation and one character, typically. But it has to be a situation that's interesting enough to me and has enough possible directions that it can go in that it grips me and I've got enough to work with. So with this one, I didn't really know anything about the story other than I like the idea of a woman who's somewhere where she shouldn't be, who has an accident and then has to account for herself, and she has a husband who can't understand what she was doing, and she either can't or won't explain what she was up to, and then the police becoming involved and trying to, you know, they're playing that cat and mouse game with her, trying to pin the murder on her. So that's sort of all I had to begin with. And that's enough of a premise for me that's interesting. I don't know who's been murdered. I don't know what she's running from. I don't know what she's up to. I don't know anything about the relationship between her and her husband. But it's got enough potential to go off in enough different twisty directions to keep me going. So that's how I start. Same thing with the couple next door. I just started with the idea of the couple leaving the baby at home and going to a party and what would happen if they did that. And then it becomes a twisty sort of story after that. So I kind of feel my way as I go along, but as long as I have a premise that is emotionally interesting to me, then I can make a story out of it.
And at what point in the process do you as writer kind of figure it out, or do you have to write it all the way to the end to figure it out?
You know, it kind of depends. With Couple, I wrote it all the way to the end and figured it out at the end. With Stranger, you know, I can barely remember now because I'm just reaching the end of my third, the first draft of my third novel, and I'm just figuring that one out. My third one, I'm having to figure it out a bit before the end because it's quite complicated.
Yeah, I was going to say usually, there's a lot of complications to figure, you know. I guess you'd have to go back.
Yeah. Thrillers are very tricky to write because you've got to keep a lot of balls in the air at once, and, you know, you've got to keep enough it's a lot of sleight of hand going on to keep your reader interested and to keep all these things that might happen. And then towards the end, I decide which one is the one that really is going to happen and which ones are the red herrings.
Yeah.
So I guess that keeps it interesting for me. I keep writing because I'm not really sure how it's all going to end. So I'm typically pretty close to the end before I know exactly how it's going to end. But I'd say by about the three-quarter mark, I kind of have a pretty good idea of how it's going to go.
I think that's really critical because I feel like if the writer knows, the reader's going to know somehow. And it's really the work of the subconscious that nobody knows and everybody's trying to figure it out that really tricks the reader. And so I think that's a great way to approach it.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I find, some people disagree and say, well, you have to plan it out. But the more writers I speak to, a lot of us work, using the subconscious because it does feel fresh that way to me. If you don't know what's going to happen and you're writing because you want to find out, then it does have that sort of really alive feeling. But some people do plan, and, their books come out just as well. And so I think it's just whatever works for you. My style is certainly to write from the seat of my pants and then sort of fix it all up later if things aren't working the way they should. Then when I go back and I revise, I make sure all the loose ends are tied up and there's no parts that don't make sense.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is once you get it all the way written through, trying to make sure that it all holds together. And
yeah, I do a lot of rewriting, because when you write a first draft without a plan, you're going to need to do a lot of rewriting. And I think, all books get a lot of rewritings anyway. But yeah, there's lots of rewrites to figure out if that was in fact the right way to finish it, if, something else has to be built up for the ending to work or something else has to be taken out or changed or there's a lot of fiddling that goes on afterwards to make it all come together properly.
Do you have a number of readers for it to kind of give it a fresh look to make sure that it all holds up?
Oh, yes. My first reader is my agent, who has a phenomenal eye for thrillers and just a wonderful sense for what works and what doesn't. And then I also have four close friends who are good readers. They're not writers, but they're readers. So they're not professionals. So I have my reader friends who just like to read and aren't writers themselves. They give me their input. I have four of those. And then I have my agent, who's got a really good critical eye. And then, of course, I have my editors, and I have editors. I have a U.S. editor, I have a U.K. editor, and I have a Canadian editor. And they all get together, and we go over it many times. So there's lots of pairs of eyes look at the book before it's done.
And let's talk about research, because there's, I know you were a lawyer in your prior life, and so that gives you some leg up in the legalities. But talk a little bit about what kind of research this book required, making sure that all the procedural stuff was down pat, and if you have people in, either police departments or detectives or doctors kind of looking over it as well.
Yeah, no, I part of the research I have to do is because I live in Canada and my books are all set in Upper New York State, so things have different names. You call your police officers different names than we call them in Canada. There's different laws. Like, for instance, the drunk driving charges up here are called I don't even remember, but in the U.S. they're called DU, driving.
Yeah, driving. Well,
under
actually,
the influence.
It varies from state to state even here. Some places.
Oh, okay.
It's
so anyway, all that stuff I have to fact check really carefully, what things are called. I had to do a lot of research on this one about driving offenses, simple things like being charged with reckless driving like she was. I mean, I had to look into, how serious was that? You can do jail time for that. You can, it's a felony. It's called a DUI, all that sort of stuff. And I had to do quite a bit of research on how the police departments are organized and the names of the detectives and how the detective work happens. Because you can't rely on TV to give you a sense of how these things necessarily work.
Right.
Like, not every police department is large enough and sophisticated enough to have an incident room and 20 detectives on the case,
Yes, right.
So I had to do quite a bit of research into that. And having the law background is certainly helpful for me for this book, because there is quite a bit of legal stuff in it, but it was more as a background comfort level. I still had to do a bit of research on, on how laws work in the U.S. versus here.
Right. I'd forgotten that, yeah, you're in Canada. That does complicate
yeah.
it a little bit more.
But, I mean, the basic common law is the same in Canada and the U.S. It's the legislative stuff, the statute law I have to be careful about.
Right.
Yeah, but people, readers don't look too deeply into that, but I like to get it right because I don't want anyone to call me up and say, that's not what we call it in New York or whatever.
I was going
to
say, there's always one reader who's going to, read it with a fine-tooth comb.
I know. And I always do research on, for this one, I had to do quite a bit of research on how to disappear.
Yeah,
and it's not that easy. Like, you think it's so easy, and in a way it's easy because people do it. Like, there are thousands and thousands of people who disappear every day and every year in the United States because they want to. And I read this fabulous book. I can't remember what it's called now. I don't know if I should give it a plug or not because I don't think I mentioned it in the book. But I read a book called, what was it called? Playing Dead, A Journey Through the World of Death Fraud by Elizabeth Greenwood.
Wow.
And that was very interesting. It was about how people try to fake their death and disappear. So I found that very interesting. I didn't use anything out of it directly, but, the subtleties of disappearing, of trying to disappear, it's getting harder and harder to do that with technology being what it is.
Yes.
It's not like 50 right. years ago you could just dig up some death certificate and take over someone's birth certificate, but it's not so easy anymore.
Oh,
so
no,
I had
right.
to do a fair bit of looking into that.
Right, and with social media and everybody taking a photograph every 5 minutes and
that's certainly tripped up my heroine.
Right,
It's very hard to go underneath the radar nowadays.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
right. So good. My guest this morning is Sherry LaPena. The book is A Stranger in the House. You're listening to Writers on Writing. Let's talk a little bit about unreliable narrators because they're kind of everybody. Everybody in this book is somewhat of an unreliable narrator. It's got switching points of view. All of that, I think, is tricky for a writer to keep, to be in a person's point of view and still have them as unreliable. I think those are the most fun narrators, but they must also be the most challenging to write. And I was wondering if you have any tips and tricks for writers on how to accomplish that.
Yeah, that's a very good question. How do you do that? I don't know if I can give any technical tips on how to, how to have an unreliable narrator be effective.
You just know it when you see it.
That is such a hard thing to describe. I find that it's not hard to get into a character's head. I do that quite readily. And then, if sometimes I will find that the character has been manipulating me a little bit. Like something will happen and I'll have my own aha moment and I'll go, I can talk about Couple Next Door. Like in my first book, when I got about a third of the way through the book and the husband, it turns out the husband had actually arranged to have the baby taken. That was an aha moment for me. I hadn't realized until that moment that he had actually been behind it. So he was unreliable because he was manipulating me, so I guess he was manipulating the reader. So I don't know that I can.
Yeah, that's.
I mean, if I could bottle how to write an unreliable narrator and sell it, I would. But
You'd have a lot of buyers.
yeah, because they're great. Everybody loves them. And to be honest, the more it's done, the harder it is to do it, because readers are expecting an unreliable narrator now.
Right.
It's not like decades ago when Agatha Christie did it with The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, Now we're all sort of very suspicious of everyone in the book.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think it's almost more interesting when the narrators are lying to themselves somehow, that they've kind of bought into their own psychological tricks that they played on other people. They've kind of bought into it themselves because I think that's how you have to live.
Yes. And that's my favorite kind of unreliable narrator, when they don't even know that they're lying to themselves, because that's easier to do in a way. And people do it. You see people all the time denying things their kids did, denying things they did. Like, it's amazing how much people can rationalize what they've done and rationalize things away and deny things. Like, it's quite interesting. So, yeah, when people deny and rationalize to themselves, it makes them very interesting, and you can do a lot with that as a writer.
Yes, yes. And I also want to talk about just living in the world as a writer and, you know, separate and apart from the time you spend at your computer working on the books. If you find yourself, now that you've switched from law to writing, if you find that you just live in the world in a different way, if you feel like you eavesdrop on conversations more, or you keep notebooks, or you comb the newspaper for, or the internet for, you know, ideas, or just kind of how you navigate your way in the world as a writer?
You know what? I don't actually know. I don't think there's anything different except that I'm much happier being at home being a writer than I ever was having a job outside the house. I don't actually keep a notebook for ideas. I must be one of the few who don't. I've always been very curious about people, and I sort of listen and watch and observe and read the paper, and I have always been like that. I don't actually look at the paper for ideas. I guess I've always just been looking for ideas my whole life, or just, I'm just curious about human nature. Mm-hmm. And I do a lot of reading. Like, I'll read books about psychopaths, and I'll read, I read a lot of crime fiction. I'm sorry, I think that's the garbage truck.
No, it's good. I really liked the background. I really liked the sirens in the background, because it was a perfect backdrop for the garbage truck is good too.
So I don't, you know, as a writer, I don't think I'm that different a person. I mean, my lifestyle is very different, but I don't. The difference is I'm disciplined and I write every day as a professional writer. But I, like I said, I don't really keep a lot of notebooks or things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't keep a journal or anything like that. I have an idea that speaks to me, just usually out of the air. And then I start writing, and I write consistently, and it just grows from there. I'm quite disciplined about my writing.
I love that. I always ask writers at the end about writing advice that they would share, you know, thriller writing advice. But maybe that's it, to write every day and to be disciplined about it. I don't know if you have other advice you want to share, but that's a good one.
And as far as writing thrillers goes, or as far as writing anything goes, my advice is always, write the story that is the one that most interests you emotionally. Mm-hmm. If you're excited emotionally about it, or something about it intrigues you, then I would just write it. And don't believe, like people tell you, that you have to have a thriller all plotted out, because that's why I postponed writing a thriller for so many years, because I thought you'd have to plot it out. And that's not how I wrote my earlier books. I just wrote from an idea and carried through the way I do with the thrillers. So I was intimidated, and I didn't even try a thriller until I'd written other books. So I would just say, whether you're writing a thriller or anything, write the book that you're most emotionally excited about, and don't worry about what other people will like or what the market is or anything, because if you write the book that you like and write it the way that you like, then you'll find your own voice for it, and then, you know, you can worry about the editing later.
Great.
I think a lot of beginning writers, I think, try to edit too early, and then they end up censoring themselves, and they get all blocked.
Yeah.
And I think that's the biggest mistake a writer can make, is trying to wear two hats at once. You can't wear the creative hat and the editing hat at the same time. You have to do the writing first, and then you look at it critically afterwards. If you do it at the same time, you just stop yourself.
So true. That is so true. That is,
and
that
I've necessary. Seen this in students. I used to teach English, and this is the problem people have, and why they say, I can't write, I don't have any ideas. It's always because they're letting their censor take the front seat, instead of letting their unconscious and their creative impulse take the front seat. And if you write it, you can always fix it later, but most people don't get to the point where they have a full draft written, because they've got their critical hat on the whole time.
Such
so that's my advice to writers. Don't be too critical of your own work too early.
Love it. Love it. And so
yeah.
True. So true. Sherry
LePain. God knows there's people to be critical of it afterward.
There's plenty of time for that. Right? thank you so much for taking the time, Sherry. This was wonderful.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Sherry LaPena. The book is A Stranger in the House. It is out and available now. That is all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great, great day.